สัพพะทวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมทัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมทัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังนะมัสสามิFirst, I'd like to welcome back Bhante Asaji. Just returned from Sri Lanka yesterday. Nice to have you back, Bhante. The last day of 1997. It's good to see many friends here. And the tradition in Thailand where I was trained is one where lay people would come to the monastery andmeditate through to midnight. And Ajahn Chah would be there. And usually only his closest disciples would come and to chat with their families. So very low-key, very friendly, very loving. I have very pleasant, fond memories of those New Year's Eves and at Wat Pa Pong in Thailand. So it's nice to continue this tradition here. The New Year is a pretty arbitrary line. It could happen any time, really. It's just what our culture has chosen to be the New Year today. But it is a good time to reflect and contemplate, to create spaces for reflection and contemplation help a lot, really. And I think Janus, the god of January, was the two-headed god, looking back and looking forward. So we look back into 1997 and ponder where we've been and look forward into 98 and where we're going. And yet the transcendent religious path is you haven't been anywhere and you're not going anywhere. This is a true mystery. We have this kind of conventional sense of time, and then we have this transcendent realization of the timeless. And it's plugging into that transcendent realization which is obviously most difficult. Time seems so very real and so very compelling, and we very much identify with that in our personal histories. But to realize the timeless, the eternal Nibbana, this is the religious aspiration. This is a very subtle endeavor. It isn't done through violence. You can't violently get yourself into Nibbana. You can't beat yourself up to be enlightened. You can't hate yourself. You can't hate your problems into Nibbana. This doesn't work. So it's ahimsa. It's non-violent. It's a non-violent path. You can't will yourself into it. You can't persuade yourself into it. You can't drink yourself into it. You can't read yourself into it. All of that doesn't work, and most of us have tried it. So what is the way we realize this deepest aspiration? So I suppose we look back into 97, at 97, whatever memories we have left, and hopefully we've seen some of the ways you can't realize Nibbana. And so hopefully we've whittled down some of the options that we took, and we realized, well, no, that didn't work. And that's wisdom. And that creates a certain aura in the present moment, a certain way of being, doesn't it? All the mistakes that I've made, if I've reflected and contemplated, then that creates a certain way that I'm operating now. And that's good. So mistakes are not lost if we have the willingness to reflect upon them and don't take them personally. Mistakes are not personal, they're just mistakes. They happen because of ignorance. They arise because of causes. And the skill of the contemplative is to contemplate results and see which results are skillful, which are unskillful. I know for myself, a lot of my willfulness and practice that I got very much caught up in my early years in Thailand, at that time, it seemed pretty stupid. Things that I kind of got up into meditation, forcing myself, you know, all kinds of asceticism. But I'm really grateful now that I did it, because it created a lot of clarity around what I shouldn't be doing, about what is wrong or what is incorrect, about the wrong path. So understanding the wrong path puts you on the right path. So there's nothing really lost in the practice if one has the willingness to reflect. And then so looking forward into 1998, there's a tendency to make determinations to fulfill one's aspiration. And of course the question is, how do we fulfill our deepest desire, our deepest yearning? Because I assume that, you know, all of us being here, we do have some profound yearning. Otherwise, we'd be out there making a party or something, or just going to sleep. So we have some deep yearning for peace or truth, whatever ways one couches that. And so what is the path? What is the way? Well, the Buddhist way is the way of insight. It's the way of wisdom. And insight is like grace. Insight doesn't come through violently forcing yourself to be wise. It doesn't come through that. Insight doesn't come from reading. It comes from seeing things clearly. And the way we see things clearly, why do we? You ever thought about that? Why does insight arise? So like, let's say tomorrow I'm going to force myself to want to have an insight, right? So tomorrow at 4 o'clock I will have an insight. It doesn't work that way. I'm going to have an insight. You can't force it that way. The Christian idea of grace is something that doesn't people, usually in Buddhism we don't relate to that. It's the idea of something fortuitous given by God, I suppose. That's the sort of idea. But it's something that really empowers your practice or strengthens your confidence. And insight is that way, because insight arises when we give the opportunity for wisdom to function. And this is why no amount of reading or no amount of forcefulness or no amount of coercion will show us the timeless, the eternal. It's only by making ourselves available for grace, making ourselves available for truth, allowing truth to arise rather than trying to catch the truth. It's only in that kind of humility, really, that wisdom can function. And this is hard to do. I don't know about you, but I've often had in my own practice times where I've really tried hard to do a retreat and really do a lot of anapanasati and read the Visuddhimagga and you know, kind of really trying very hard to get enlightened, or at least to get some level of trance or some kind of insight. Anything, I'll take anything, damn it. Sort of desperation in the mind after a few weeks. And then it all crumbles, right? One's knees are hurting one, and you know, you've walked up down the path for 20 times, you just can't get anything anymore. And it seems hopeless and pathetic, and you give up, and there's insight. And how many of us have had that? I think we've all had that. And why is that? Because we have given up. We have given up the effort to become or to get rid of or to attain. And we've, in some painful way, we've opened up our hearts to suchness, to the way things are. And that way of opening up and allowing and being available is something I think that, for me, it's taken a long time, and I continue to learn how to do that through all the mistakes of not allowing that to happen. Being available, allowing, opening, requires some time. And if we are always busy filling the mind, be it if we're always filling the mind with our own control mechanisms, if we're always filling the mind with information, with work, with distraction, with just doing, thinking, judging, analyzing, if that is, our attention is continually preoccupied in that way, we don't give space. And if we don't give space, we don't get grace. Yeah? So in a place like this, hopefully it is that opportunity to do nothing. And people can come here and not be egos, and not be busy, and not be productive, and not be clever, and not be beautiful, and all the rest of what keeps our society busy, and just to be present, just to witness to the way things are. And that's very, very, very simple, actually, isn't it? Very simple just to be, and yet extraordinarily difficult. Because we have all these ideas of what we have to become and what's wrong with us and what we have to get rid of. But insight doesn't arise from that struggle. It arises more from a space of humility and poverty. Poverty not in the sense of being broke, not having any money, but poverty in the sense of not knowing, not judging, not analyzing, a sense of humbleness and openness to the way things are. This is where the ideas of faith come forth, the faith mind, the trusting mind, all of which is foreign to the mind which wants to control and already has a whole set of judgments about why I'm wrong and what's wrong with me and what I should do and what I should become. From wisdom or from insight, all the other beautiful qualities of human heart can begin to manifest, can't they? And we as human beings have a really wonderful kind of possibilities. The human heart, what can come forth from it. Just say, like, we have the ability to appreciate beauty. So most of us saw this beautiful crescent moon with the evening star floating through this beautiful blue sky. I mean, it was so exquisite. I can see that right from my window. I'm very lucky. So I just turned the lights off and watched it for an hour. So what a privilege I have to be able to do that. Not only have the window, but have the time. And maybe have the peace too. But that's a quality we have as human beings, don't we? We can appreciate beauty. But also as human beings, we can see more deeply that and realize that some days it's going to be cloudy. And that I can't always have that. I can't always have that kind of sky at the end of December, a warm day, a beautiful day like this. And that which is deeper, which sees that, is of course wisdom. It sees beauty. It knows beauty. And it knows beauty in the context of beauty and ugliness. And that, so wisdom is deeper than beauty. And wisdom is like a benediction, a blessing, isn't it? And we receive blessings, or we receive that benediction of light, which is wisdom, when we have the willingness to witness to the way things are. And it is simple. Just witness to the way things are. Be available. And from that trusting openness, there is benediction, there is light, there is wisdom. And that's grace. Not from a person, but rather from nature. Nature has that in it. Nature has blessings in it. They are available. And if we enter into a way of wisdom, which is what Buddhism is really about, the way of wisdom, our whole way of operating at the emotional level begins to be transformed. It's a kind of transformative process. And this transformation isn't an act of will. I don't know about you, but I've noticed that I'll be aware of some negative mind state, just sitting there and watching my mind complain about something or be anxious about something, and just allow myself to witness to that. Just to feel it in my body, make no judgments about it, just allow it to come through. And then lo and behold, I sit through that and I walk out of my room or the shrine room and my heart feels more loving, more caring, more attentive, more sensitive. And it's not because I've done it as an act of will. I haven't sat there and said, now, you're dumb, you stop being anxious and be more loving. That doesn't work, does it? But if, I don't know, this is what I've noticed, is just being attentive to the very experience of anxiety is transformative. It's that very attention, it's that very awareness is transformative. Perhaps because it isn't me doing it. Perhaps because I'm no longer judging it according to my limited perceptions of how things should be. Perhaps because that is the way that nature transforms the awareness. Awareness isn't like an egotistical statement. Awareness is a witnessing and awakening to the way things are. And it's this sense of transformation which we often don't trust. We tend to trust more desire and fear, our manipulativeness, our judgments, and just the simple act of being aware or being awake, we tend not to trust. So in this kind of transformative process, the whole, because there isn't this sense of self trying to control it, what happens is that the whole way we interpret the world begins to change. It's no longer a world for me, a world which I am opposed to or I'm seeking something in, but it's more and more a unitive experience. And what arises from that kind of wisdom is empathy. And empathy is a completely different way of relating to the world of people and experience. Empathy is the way of putting yourself in the shoes of someone else. Empathy is unitive. Desire, infatuation, fear, these are separative kinds of states of mind. And the wonder of awareness, the wonder of practice of awareness, if I can witness to the very feelings of separation and alienation as they arise, as desire or jealousy, or fear, or anxiety, all these endless trivia of the human mind, all these painful things that we experience, the very fact that we experience them with pure awareness creates a kind of unitive heart. This is the wonder of it. If I feel, I feel anxious about something, and I simply witness to that anxiety, I bear witness to that, in a kind of available way, I make myself available to the feeling of anxiety, then the transformative process is such that that anxiety is no longer my identity. And with the death of anxiety is a kind of unitive empathy for the anxiety of all beings, just for the way things are. And it's the sense of deep empathy is the emotional freedom of the human being. Emotionally, we become actually more and more alive. We don't become deadened in any way. Empathy doesn't come about through forcing yourself to be loving. Empathy comes about through loving your hatred, I suppose, being aware of your hatred. This is curious, isn't it? Now, it's a really strange one. You can sit and watch yourself in a rage, and be, if you're mindful of it, you're not judging it, and kind of come out of it feeling more loving. Or you can sit and suppress your rage and try to love everyone and come out more hating. Have you ever done that one? You know, you feel angry, so you think, well, the book says do metta practice, right? So you kind of push the anger away and you say, may they be well. And you get up and you hate them. First person you see, you want to strangle them. Why is that? Because it's just an overlay of an idea that we put on top of how we feel. It's violence, actually. It's interesting how the practice of loving kindness can be violent. We do violence to the way things are. But pure loving kindness, transcendent loving kindness, is total empathy for the way things are. You know, it's empathy for my anger, it's empathy for your anger. It's a completely non-judgmental, non-discriminating kind of experience. So the path of Buddhism then is this way of wisdom and the way of empathy, the way of understanding and the way of emotional feeling for other beings. Self-empathy is an important one. Sounds strange, empathy usually relate to someone else, but the more one can relate to one's own suffering, to one's own difficulties with a sense of empathy, the fears I have and the angers I feel, both responsibility and empathy. Obviously, if I blame anything for my suffering, then I'm never going to understand it. But the sense of truly going into witnessing, to really witness to something, you have to empathize with it, to really witness to my own despairs or irritations or restlessness, to really witness to that, to be available to that, there has to be empathy. And empathy is quite a good word, because it's like really you're going into the suffering of another being. So that anguish or fear or anger that I feel as a human being is a suffering. It's a suffering in the universe. And to empathize with that, what does it mean to empathize with anger that you're feeling? To really empathize with that anger means that is the quality of witnessing that we're trying to cultivate. And you see, when that quality is operating, even though the object of consciousness is like anger, the underlying karma, intention, attitude is what? Is empathy, is wisdom. And then that is always going to be the result, empathy and wisdom. But any kind of coercion or force, and observe, I don't know about your own mind, I've suffered so much from the endless kind of violence that I do to myself in my practice, the endless kind of judgments and this wasn't quite right, and you didn't do, you know, this endless kind of tyranny of the judging mind, yeah? Which is violent, isn't it? It's a very violent kind of thing. Yeah, it's not. I don't beat myself with chains, you know, but there is a kind of violence that can sometimes go down as awareness. But that's not really awareness. That's not being aware, because I'm not aware of the primary intention behind it. Yeah? Whereas empathy is obviously not violent. Empathy is this acceptance of and full feeling of one's karmic predicament. The idealized mind. An attachment to idealism is quite often very violent in an inward way, because the idealized mind very quickly sees how things should be and then judges everything that doesn't fit into that pattern as being not right. And so the idealized mind, when it's attached to, becomes a tyrant. My ideals about how you should be and how I should be is the kind of violence I do to you or to me. And I might hit you, might even be nice to you, but maybe inside, the language that I relate to you with might be very, very unkind and violent. And then, of course, the karmic result of that is I will refer back to myself in the same kind of judgmental way. And so how to break that pattern of the practice being, you know, the practice isn't just a pattern of continually criticizing and finding fault and judgment with the way things are, but it's having empathy with the way things are. This is true mindfulness. It's truly feeling the way things are. So whether it's my own suffering or your suffering, it's really feeling that in my heart, that what does this suffering feel like? It's where true awareness comes, manifests. And in that loving space, and in that empathetic space, insight has a chance to arise. But as long as the mind is preoccupied with like judgment, if you're suffering from something or some kind of difficulty is going through your consciousness, some grief or anger, and one is continually engaged with that with judgment, or one is continually engaged with that with analysis, one is constantly thinking about it or judging it or trying to get rid of it or doing practices, one never really stops and grace never arises, insight never arises. We don't give it a chance. So it's this sense of, you know, stopping, waiting, being available, being empathetic to the situation. From that, insight arises. And from insight arises all the other qualities, the obvious necessity of patience and determination. These kinds of factors arise because we understand, we see clearly the way things are. The force of karma, again, the idealized mind sees very quickly what should happen, but what the idealized mind doesn't understand is the force of karma, the force of habit. And the more you practice, the more you see that in the text they give an image of the work that we do. There's an image of a sea coast with a cliff that falls into the ocean, and there's the image of a beach which goes very, very slowly into the ocean. And the Buddha says it's the image of the beach really that we have to keep in mind. It's not the cliff, kind of suddenly everything changes, but it's rather like this kind of gentle, gradual progression. And the progression is always, it's not like you're getting more or you're attaining more, but it's more you're letting go, and the sense of availability and pure presence becomes more and more obvious. You know, it's not an acquisition, it's a letting go. It's not like you're acquiring something, it's you're abandoning wrong views and wrong efforts. So the whole way of the Buddhist practice is very much opposed to the worldly way. The worldly way is always to attain, to get rid of. So it's always bound by time. You're always, I'm here now, and I have to do this hard work, and if I really, you know, practice hard, and I do this and I do that, then at the end, you know, I'll get this reward called Nibbana. Or at least I'll be happy. The religious way isn't that way. It's not so much an acquisition as a realization. That's not the way. This isn't the way. Let go of that. Let go of this. And one always comes back to the ineffable sense of pure presence. And that pure presence becomes more and more subtle. More and more the sense of, what is it that knows? You know, you think about last year. I was trying to dredge up some memories of last year. But where did it go? What is that? Where does memory, you know, it's just a kind of vague haze now. And it was all so important then, wasn't it? And so what is it that stays? This is what religion is trying, for me, perennial religion is trying to get us to intuit. What is it that stays? What is it that endures? What is it that's eternal? Is there anything eternal, or is it all just changing? And the sense of abandoning greed, abandoning hatred, abandoning delusion, abandoning fear, abandoning all that, what happens to the mind is the mind begins to have more and more an intuitive sense of that the world, actually, that whole chronological world of me in it, begins to have less power. It begins to seem much, much less real. It's less compelling. It's less demanding. And that sense of identity as being someone in the world of time and space and becoming, all of that begins to fall away. And there's an intuition of the eternal. And that's not something that you pin down with the intellect. It's more something you feel with the heart. It's very kind of vague in the beginning. And our focus in this kind of a place is this continual reference to this moment. So if I have a thought that last year I was a hopeless case, well, that's a thought now. Or next year I'm going to do this or do that, that's a thought now. That I'm going to be traveling to Canada, that's a thought now. If one continually sees that this feeling of anxiety they have about the future is something now, and this regret about the past that I have is something now, and something now and something now and something now, then one begins to intuit more the eternal sense of presence, rather than identifying with personal history and personal possibilities in the future. Whereas if I identify with, like if I have a memory of something that happened last year, and I reinforce with that with the thought, I shouldn't have done this and I shouldn't have done that, and if I had done this and then if I hadn't done that, then if only I had, if I reinforce the sense of me in time. But I never really see that as Dhamma. But to see that as Dhamma, I say, well, that's a thought. It's a feeling. Without having to get into some kind of philosophical argument about did it really happen, to put down all the thinking, but just to know right now, what is that? That's a feeling of regret. Or that's a feeling of joy. It's always here now, here now, here now, here now, here now, here now. Present, 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 always. And this is the continual practice that we try to do. We try to awaken to the present moment. And so we try to break down the whole sense of personal history in ways like this is just a thought, or this is just a feeling, or this is just the body, or this is just a sight, or this is just a sound. To break it down in that way, rather than I'm feeling and I'm hoping and it's terrible and they shouldn't and all that kind of sense of me, 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 me. And this breaks down that delusion, the delusion of time, that I'm someone born in time. There's a kind of paradox. Chronological time still functions, right? You still... What was I doing? I was filling in my Philofax for talks at the Buddhist Society. And I still have to do that. So 17th of May, I filled in my diary for a talk at the Buddhist Society, right? And the curious thing is, okay, and I fill that in, and probably it will arrive, or I'll die before then, whatever. But it'll arrive and I'll go on the 17th of May to the Buddhist Society. But the only thing I can really know is it always happens now. I can never prove the past. You can show me my birth certificate. You can't actually, it's lost in Germany somewhere. You can show me my passport. This is a very time when you were born, such and such place, yeah. But I can't prove it. I can only know this present moment. And this is the kind of paradox of the religious life. And that's not to deny chronological time. You know, we still live in that relative reality. And so Buddhism tries to say, well, there is the relative, okay? And the relative we have to live in and we have to honor in some way. And that's what we surrender to. Mind and body, we give ourselves to your file of facts, okay? But then the Buddha's suggestion was there's another level of reality which we need to consider. There's another way of looking at this whole business of being a human being. And this is what religion is about. This is why Buddhism isn't just some kind of humanism or just something to make you feel good. But religion is touching a whole different dimension of consciousness, the eternal. And that's done by looking at like the very feeling of time. The whole sense of, like I'll do things, like I'll sit and watch my clock for half an hour. Very productive. have you ever done that? You think, you know, what's a half an hour? I mean, have you ever made time for watching your clock for half an hour? No, just do that. Just watch your clock for half an hour. When did time pass? Was it a fast hour? Was it a slow hour? You can only know the present moment. You can know the feeling of time is, God, this is going on forever. Or, that was fast. You can know that feeling, but you can only know that in the present moment. You can have a feeling like about the future, that you're anxious. What's going to happen? What am I going to do when that interview? But you can only know that in the present moment. You can have a memory of someone who hurt you, betrayed you. You can know that in the present moment, or you can create yourself around that. So the memory manifests, and the memory is unpleasant, and then there's all the associations of memory and time, and then I'm never going to talk to them again, and God, they might be there, so I better not go there tomorrow. And the whole sense of self is created. But in any moment, that can be known. that can be known as a sense of self, which has arisen because of causes, and it will cease. And where does it cease? It always ceases in the present moment. So there's this ever-changing present moment. Now, this isn't just kind of trying to be clever with words. It's trying to get us to look in another way, look more deeply, look differently at our experience. And what Buddhism is trying to point to is, as long as we're preoccupied with all the elements of time, as long as we're preoccupied with the sense world, as long as we're preoccupied with desire and fear, we cannot realize the deathless. Because that preoccupation, again, as I was saying the other night, keeps you very much on the surface. It's like you can't, like I was saying, you're constantly walking around the temple. You never find the doors, you know, the brickwork and the windows. And where are the doors? Where are the doors to the deathless? It's always the sense of knowing the way things are, which is something you receive. You receive this moment. You're available to it rather than try to find something in it. If I'm always trying to find something, you know, some kind of experience, be you call it enlightenment or whatever you want to call it, then I'm not available. But if I'm trying to get enlightened, how can I get, you know, I'm not available for enlightenment. Sorry, he's not here. He's out looking for enlightenment. You have to be here to be enlightened. You get the idea. And so the doors to the deathless are this very, very subtle, but very simple sense of waiting, being, knowing this present moment the way it is. You can have the most awful feeling. You can have the most murderous feeling. And if you witness to that and you have faith and trust in that, that most murderous, awful feeling will end in the silence of the mind, in the emptiness of the mind. You can have the most ethereal, beautiful feeling, and that will also end in the same space. You can choose the ethereal and deny the hellish, and you'll be on a treadmill for many eons. We can appreciate beauty, but also we can have empathy for that which is painful. And so the religious lives takes us to a whole different appreciation of the sense realm. The religious appreciation of the sense realm is one of gratitude for the beautiful, patience with the difficult. The deluded way of looking at the sense world is greed for the beautiful, fear of loss of the beautiful and the safe and the secure, aversion to that which is not lovely, fear of that which is not lovely, fear and desire. And the wonder of awareness is that the very sense world, which is where we get trapped, actually begins to be have a different quality. We appreciate it in a different way. So it's not that we close down the senses or become in some way insensitive and dull to the sense world, but our interpretation of it changes because it's not something that we're demanding anymore, that beautiful...